Newton, Massachusetts.
Today about our institutions, and for understandable reasons. These complaints are based upon the fact that our institutions are not as democratic or as open to participation as they ought to be. And one of the reasons is that past generations of Americans have been indifferent and apathetic, not only about voting, but more importantly about participating on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month, year-to-year basis in the policy-making that goes on in a community, not only in local government, but in so many civic activities. This is a government, remember, based upon participation by what we hope will become an enlightened and informed people. The ideal, then, would be a situation in which each citizen had the judgment-making capacity to make decisions about important problems which face their governments. You don't do this by simply reading the headlines in the morning paper from time to time after you've read the sports pages and the comics. You've got to dig into these problems. They're difficult and complex, and they involve understanding not only such difficult subjects as economics and political organization, but other people. People who live in another part of town, or in another part of the state, or in another part of the country. This is what these youngsters are complaining about. That there's no place for them that they can see to make an impact upon the policies which make them unhappy. Now, most of us in this room, I think, have been preoccupied since the 30s with the question of economic insecurity. We all remember the Depression and what it did to us. And ever since, we've been working for the objective of economic security for ourselves, economic growth for the country, because that's what produces opportunity and economic security for the citizen. Well, now these kids who have just grown up and are in college have never known economic insecurity. They don't know what it means. And so material things no longer appeal to them as an objective in life, as they have for us. They want a challenge to the spirit, to the intellect. They want the things that make life worthwhile because they challenge you to grow mentally and spiritually and in understanding and compassion. That's what they want. And they understand what too few of us do. That the problems of those who do not yet have a stake in our society, the disadvantaged and the deprived, could be solved if other Americans would develop in this other way which I've just described. And really, that's what America is all about. You know, when we began back in 1787, only those who owned property could vote, and not all of those. And since that time, we've gradually expanded the franchise to include males who did not own property and who were over the age of 21, to include women. And then we've undertaken to break down the barriers against those of different colors, different racial origins. We've undertaken to broaden the franchise in order to bring in as many Americans as possible into the business of running the country. And we've also made our institutions, our governmental institutions, more and more responsive to people. Senators were once elected by state legislatures, until World War I. Now they're elected by the people. At the turn of the century, the people rebelled against the idea that state legislatures were too much controlled by special interests. So they enacted into law such things as the initiative and the referendum and the recall to make state legislatures subject to the will of the people. And so this has been a whole thrust of American history, to bring more and more people into the business of running the country, and to make our institutions more and more responsive to participation and to the needs of the people. Now, this is what the founders had in mind. They understood that when we became crowded, this would be difficult. Because when you're crowded into cities, the individual feels less important, less significant, less able to influence public policy, less able to shape the forces that shape his life. And so it takes an extra special effort. And we've got to find new ways to bring people into the business of shaping their own neighborhoods. Well, now this is the sort of thing. The Democratic Party, beginning with the leadership of John Kennedy and then President Johnson, has been trying to do. We've tried to reform our institution. We haven't gone as far as we'd like. Such things as model cities, for example. An experiment in developing self-government within blighted areas of a city. And to help them by making available to them the resources of the community, of the state, and of the federal government. To help them upgrade their conditions and find dignity and opportunity and hope. Without hope, no American is going to be satisfied with this system. We've got to find ways to bring hope to every American within the limits of this country. And I'm here with you. And so we've worked at education. You know, President Washington, the first president, in his first message to the first Congress of the United States, pointed out the responsibility of the Congress to provide for education. And it wasn't until the 1960s that the Congress finally enacted the first federal aid to education bill in the history of our country, at the primary and secondary level. And education is the very foundation of a free society. Education makes it possible for the individual to get something out of life. Education makes him a better neighbor. Education makes him inclined to build a better community. Education makes it possible for us to build a more enlightened and better country in which all of us can live. And it took us all this time to do it. And now in a single year, the federal government spends on education more than the federal government spent in all of the 180 years prior to John F. Kennedy on education. Now, is this a worthwhile expenditure of public funds? You're being told by Mr. Wallace that we're spending too much. Are expenditures for education spending too much? What else are we spending for? Well, we're spending to create jobs. And as a result, we are today investing more in this country, twice as much, in 1968, in new factories and manufacturing plants than we were in 1960. Well, is that spending too much? What else are we spending for? We're spending for housing. But everyone in this room knows that second to having children in a family, owning your own home, is the most precious objective in the lives of any man and woman. Is that spending too much? We're spending five times as much each year, and this isn't enough, as the last administration, of which Mr. Nixon was a part, was willing to spend for water pollution cleanup. And it isn't enough. And in 1958, we tried to increase that. In 1959, from $50 to $90 million a year, and the president vetoed it. And it took a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress to get that program up to the level where it ought to be. Now, we can't increase the supply of water on this planet. Fresh water constitutes 1% of the total water supply of this planet. And it's been the same since Adam and Eve. Now, we understand that Apollo spacecraft up there can stay there only as long as its water and air lasts. And we know it can stay there only if that water and air are cleaned up as they're used. Well, the Earth is exactly the same kind of a spacecraft. And unless we clean up this air and water as we use it, we won't have enough to sustain life. And certainly not enough to sustain all of the activities that make civilization possible. So is spending for this spending too much? Now, this is the sort of thing we're being criticized for. The thing that's overlooked is this, that over this past 8 years, we've almost doubled the productive capacity of this country from $500 billion a year to $864 billion a year. It took 180 years to work ourselves up to $500 billion and another 8 years to build it up 364 more. And it's as a result of that growth that we've been able to do these things with schools, with housing, with new jobs. We're actually paying $16 billion less a year in taxes than we would be if we were paying the same rates that were in force in the last year of the administration of which Mr. Nixon was a part. We've cut taxes, but we've increased tax yield, we've stimulated the growth of the economy and increased our capacity to do something about schools, about health, about houses, about jobs. Is that spending too much? This is the story we've got to tell, because Americans all over this country are sorely tempted to follow alien doctrines and alien philosophies. They're sorely tempted to yield to the pressures of fear and hatred and to seek to protect themselves by dividing America. That's an alien doctrine that's never worked in any society in the entire history of man, and it wouldn't work here. The day we embark upon that kind of a policy will be the day that America begins to go downhill. We've got to continue to be an open, expanding society, open to everybody who wants to come in. And so we've got to counter that kind of talk. We've got to tell the story of hope and progress and achievement and justice that has been the story of America for 180 years. And that Democratic administrations for 8 years have done their best. No government has ever, in the history of our own country or any other, done as much in these fields to which I refer as our government in the past 8 years. Get on our wheels and let's go out into the countryside and tell this story. And if it's told on the basis of my reassuring experience up to date, we're going to roll right on, as my wife says, to victory on November 6th.
Boston College, October 21, 1968.
Chicago in a dark mood. But now that we've Now we see why he lost his political battle. McCarthy may well have won his war. He converted the Vietnam conflict from an issue of dissent to an issue of political action. Once this happened, it had precious few defenders left. Even so ardent a proponent of the war as Mac George Bundy has now opted out. And there is a candle in the window for Walt Rostow and T. Bryant. What George Ball said the other night, that this is not a matter entirely without historical interest. He, as you know, defended going into Vietnam, and he now defends what comes close to unilateral withdrawal. George was saying that this also now at long last justifies the Duke of York, who, you remember, marched his 10,000 men up the hill, marched his 10,000 men back down again. Bundy has proved that he was right both times. The negotiations for which McCarthy campaigned, and which his campaign made possible, may now be at hand. Certainly with the slightest flexibility in Washington, they could be had. And I do not doubt that Hubert Humphrey wants out. And he has also made it clear, both publicly and privately, that there will be no place in his administration for the disastrous Cold War priesthood which got us into this mess.
This is the fraud sign.
Finally, we have been reminded, Senator Muskie,
it means McCarthy should have got the nomination
in favor of Obama.
Because he's the people's choice.
That is the issue of racial tension. Like Vietnam, it is an issue that could tear the country apart. Richard Nixon, not the new Nixon, not the old Nixon, but the unreliable Nixon we've known all these years. Pretending that he invented the concept of law and order, and saying, as he did earlier this year, and here I quote, that where there is injustice and disorder, immediate and decisive force must be the first response. In short, he is showing that on this great issue, he has nothing to offer. By eliminating the inequality which is its cause. Here, between the candidates, there is a vital difference. So no doubt aided by that tendency to accommodate, which marks my generation, I have come to the support of the Humphrey Muskie ticket. Spiro Agnew. repress him. All they would have to do is ask him for a debate. I also hear it said that if Nixon wins, Agnew will be only one heartbeat away from the presidency. That doesn't impress me either. Whoever said that Nixon was all that much better? The difference between Agnew and Nixon is that Agnew says what he thinks.
Some concern to all Americans.
It's true that minority presidents in the past have been able to generate the support necessary to sustain the country's efforts to run our affairs. But we've never had quite a serious problem in those terms as we do this time. We may be able to afford a period of default in dealing with some of our pressing domestic problems in the next 4 years. But I don't think we ought to take a chance if we can avoid it. So I think we need to work at getting a majority for the next president of the United States. This election is meaningful for reasons other than the war that we all want to see end. This campaign is a contest between those who think America can realize its destiny as a free nation and those who are ready to settle for less. Between those who have confidence in the common sense and decency of the American people and those who do not trust us. And between those who would bring out the best in the American people.
Nothing new in it.
Those who would exploit the differences. The real issues in this campaign are these, it seems to me. Whether we can find security in a more peaceful world. Whether we can provide a job and a living wage for every person ready and willing to work. Whether we can provide a full education for every person on the basis of his ability to learn, not on his ability to pay. Whether we can assure that every American family has enough wholesome food to eat. Whether we can assure decent homes in decent neighborhoods where garbage is collected and streets are repaired, where housing is maintained, and where there is safety for every man, woman, and child. This is the responsibility of responsible leaders.
I don't think I can get a reception.
To obtain a better, richer, and freer America.
These cross currents.
Not just for some of us, but for all of us. It is not an easy responsibility, for it must be carried out in a rapidly changing world. When the British Army surrendered at Yorktown 187 years ago last Saturday, their band played "The World Turned Upside Down." For many Americans, that might well be the theme song of 1968. At a time when our nation is at the pinnacle of economic, technological, and military power, when our control over many aspects of our physical environment is unparalleled, we are suffering the deepest social and political divisions we have known since the Civil War. The implications of those divisions are far more serious and important than the question of political victory or defeat. The outcome of the election on November 5th may well decide our chances to survive viably those divisions as a rational democratic society. Many consider ours to be a bewildered society. The young and the old, the poor and the affluent, the black and the white. And that broad segment of our population known as the middle class are anxious and uncertain. Why, ask the young, should a society which glorifies individual choice draft us to fight in a war we oppose? Why, ask the poor, should a society which spreads the good things of life before us on television keep us from enjoying those things? Why, ask the athlete, should a society which produces great material wealth tolerate the forces of disruption? I thought I was in a room of educated, enlightened young people.
mind.
Want our country to change,
I think we all do. I think we have to tell the Democratic Party they have to become Democratic before we give them our votes. And we can tell them that by writing in the best symbol we have for the kind of change we want, and that is the symbol of a write-in for McCarthy and Conyers. Thank you.
Chosen the course in the past 2 or 3 years of undertaking to influence the shape of our policy in Vietnam by direct communication with the president, feeling that by using that method, the credibility of my advice, such as it was, with him, would be greater than if I were to do it by way of public speeches and statements. Other senators obviously chose another means, and I honor them for that. We each have our own way of expressing ourselves. There are those who are more comfortable in the role of protest and dissent and should play that role, because dissent and protest plays a valuable part in shaping our public policy. Blandness, bland conformity will never create the kinds of policies, the vital, creative, constructive policies we need, especially in these times and in the years ahead. So protest has a role, and those who are comfortable in that role, who feel that role suits them best, ought to play it, and the rest of us ought to honor it and recognize it. Others, like myself, perhaps of a more pragmatic turn of mind, while also having our convictions, seek to shape public policy by influencing it, redirecting it, by persuasion, and by use of such instruments of political power as we have, in my case, in the Senate of the United States. Now, no one of us, whatever role we choose, is going to have his own way all of the time, or perhaps any of the time. Now, on this question of withdrawal, unilateral withdrawal from Vietnam, let me point out that no presidential candidate this year has advocated unilateral withdrawal from Vietnam. No senator in the United States Senate has advocated unilateral withdrawal from Vietnam. The reason is, or the reasons are, one, that in 1954, incidentally in an administration of which Mr. Nixon was vice president, we made a commitment to a fledgling government in South Vietnam to support it, to strengthen its capacity to resist aggression, indeed, to help it create a nation of South Vietnam in contravention of what seems to me to have been the clear intent of the Geneva Accords of that year. We made the commitment. I'm sure that those who made it did not envisage the agony and the travail and the discord and the controversy and the commitment that would follow from that original one. And every president since, including the one who made it, has had to continually consider the problem of either supporting it or abandoning it. And in the process, I think we can all point to mistakes that have been made. But now we face the problem of whether we abandon the commitment or try to withdraw from it in a way that will provide minimal safeguards for the right of all of the people of South Vietnam to decide their own future. I understand there are those who find it easy to abandon such a commitment. I do not. Nor do I think it's an easy thing for our country to consider abandoning it. And I'm not pleading here any such thing as the domino theory. I don't think anything as mechanical as that is likely to follow. But an abandonment will affect the credibility, our credibility, around the world. To what extent and for how long, one can only speculate. There are some who feel that it would be minimal and that it's worth risking. There are, of course, the consequences for the people of South Vietnam to consider, too, as the result of unilateral withdrawal. Now, with respect to a bombing halt, I suggested such a halt last January in a private letter to the president. On March 31st, he decided to stop 90% of the bombing of the North, as measured by the population subject to the bombing. And I think that decision, as I recall it, was rather widely hailed as perhaps the step that we had all been waiting for, and it would lead to substantive negotiations. It has not. It may be that we're building there in Paris the base upon which a settlement can be built eventually, but if there is such a base under construction, it isn't visible, to me at least. Well, now it's urged that to discontinue the remaining 10% of the bombing will accomplish what the 90% did not. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm interested in movement toward substantive negotiations, movement as fast and as effectively as possible. And it's conceivable to me that this kind of unilateral action might have that effect. But we might also be throwing it away. It might not have the effect. And as a matter of fact, we don't really know two things about North Vietnam, at least not to my satisfaction. One, whether or not they are committed to a negotiated settlement as being in their best interests. And secondly, whether or not, if they've made such a commitment, they're ready to move toward it now. They may very well feel that by waiting, they could get a better deal.